As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm now joined by Alex Stewart.
Hello, Joe.
Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Joe.
Very exciting day today, gang. Very exciting day because we're game relevant, of course, and we're going to be talking about broad themes from three different games. The first, Arsenal-Man City. The second, Liverpool-Everton. And the third, Southampton-Chelsea. Sorry, Saints fans, we're not talking about you. Just a few bits on Chelsea there today. Also, I should say that if you like the relevance of games and you want to read more about them in a more reading way, then you should visit theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO for full access to The Athletic's range of wonderful things that you can enjoy. And at the moment, there is a special deal, I believe the deal is 50% off. So that equates to about £2.49 per month or 8p a day, gang. Pretty sure it expires fairly soon. It was based around the sort of Champions League, so I imagine you ain't got long left, friends. You probably only got this week to avail yourselves of that 8p a day at The Athletic. If you haven't tried it out before, please do. You won't be disappointed. I think you'll enjoy it greatly. So that's theathletic.com/TIFO. One more thing to look out for, released this week, I believe it might be out now, is the Beyond the Headline podcast has done a special episode on Justin Fashanu. Adam Crofton also wrote and released a piece on The Athletic about Justin Fashanu's, fair to say, incredible and weird story, and it is very much worth reading and listening to. So search for Beyond the Headline and enjoy listening to that. Seb, do you think I've done a good trail for today's episode?
Yeah, I feel like you might have alienated a couple of Southampton fans, but I feel like you've teased the rest quite nicely.
I've been trying to alienate one Southampton fan for a very long time, and he just won't
he
go away.
Clings on more so tightly. Yeah,
I feel like therefore I have a different view of what Southampton fans that can put up with. And I think there must be some of the most resilient and really tenacious people in the world. Is that right, Alex?
Yeah.
Okay, let's begin with some broad themes that came out of the Arsenal-Manchester City game. Arsenal 0-1 Manchester City. Yeah, weird game. This is my main thing that I want to say about it. It was a weird game. Alex, we were chatting during the game, and at that time you said to me, hey, the tactics are easy, but the ebb and flow is baffling. Can you expand on that, please?
Yes. By easy, what I don't mean is easy to enact.
Sure.
Not to take away anything from the complexity of the setup. What I mean is that if you watch the game, you could see quite clearly what both teams were trying to do. And yet, ordinarily, if that's the case, you can also feel the dynamic of the game. You can feel the ebb and flow, who's on top and why. Obviously, City were rampant in the first 20 minutes. Arsenal barely got a touch of the ball. And yet after that point, it felt quite almost stilted. It was like City were controlling possession, Arsenal got back into it increasingly, but it lacked the thrust and the dynamism of the first 20 minutes. The teams were still doing the same sort of stuff, but I suppose the answer to what you're saying is I don't really understand it. Like,
no, that's fine. I mean,
it wasn't like there was a massive tactical change that meant, you know, oh, okay, well, that's why they've suddenly got back into it.
It was gradual as well. Like, when I was watching it, I didn't notice until the end of the first half, when Arsenal suddenly had 5 minutes of you know, not huge opportunities, but some opportunities on goal. And then it felt very much like I'd aged 20 years and I was still doing the same thing. And then suddenly I had this moment of realization where I thought, oh, wow, I'm 50 years old and my punk band hasn't taken off. It sort of, it came all a creeping, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the way that Man City started, obviously with this very, very kind of fluid, flexible formation where De Bruyne was nominally a centre-forward out of possession but was roaming all over the place, the two central midfielders, Bernardo Silva and Gundogan, were pushing up beyond that line. You know, there was this kind of wonderful rotation, everybody gliding into position and doing all of this stuff, and it felt really exciting. And obviously they got the goal very, very early. And then they continued to do that, and Arsenal didn't really change a great deal, and all of the energy drained out of the game. And there wasn't a discernible reason for why that happened. Maybe just everyone got tired. I don't know.
Maybe. But it was strange. Can we say perhaps that the opening goal was the big error? Maybe Arsenal players just weren't concentrating yet, or it was 2 minutes in, and there'd already been a chance before that within the game. So it felt a little bit like they were being, you know, shaken awake. Is it possible that both managers' game plans were actually very good? They were, you know, they were likely to nullify each other. Because there was a goal so early, Pep Guardiola felt that he didn't really need to do anything with his team because they already had the advantage, and that Arsenal's game plan to nullify City was actually working. It just failed within the first 2 minutes, and then they didn't change it.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a couple of individual errors for that goal. I mean, Tierney lets Mahrez turn in far too easily, and between them, Bellerin and Holding should have stopped Sterling's jump somehow. That's definitely the case. But what felt odd was that, particularly for sort of the first half an hour, City continued to be really dominant, and it felt like that advantage should have been forced forwards. I don't know whether it's the absence of a centre forward to act as a focal point, but the runners were doing well and they were getting into dangerous positions. And also, if you look at how Arsenal set up, it wasn't like it was filling me with a huge amount of confidence. I mean, one of the centre-backs was often pushing up quite high out of possession to try and close down a City player, and that left huge gaps in behind. The midfield double pivot seemed to be too split apart quite often, with Elneny going quite wide to the right-hand side and Xhaka not tucking across. So I wasn't looking at Arsenal's setup and thinking, oh, they've got, you know, it wasn't like watching an Atletico Madrid 4-4-2 and you think, yeah, you can see very clearly why no one's going to break this down. It just, for whatever reason, it never quite clicked into the next level that the game promised. And even when Arsenal came back into it, they didn't come back into it in a way that felt like they convincingly had an opportunity to score.
Yeah,
it was just a strange game.
It was strange. I'd be curious to talk a little bit more about De Bruyne, because you mentioned the City's lack of a real focal point in the centre forward position. You're absolutely right. City did continue to dominate for that 15-20 minutes afterwards. I don't remember a huge number of very clear cut chances though. And I think watching the game, what was interesting for me was to see how often there was nobody in the Arsenal box. And City players had the ball in and around the 18-yard box, or a little behind that. I remember watching and thinking, well, I wonder what Guardiola's plan here is. I watch City assuming that what they're doing is always on purpose, and I just don't understand why it doesn't make sense. But it was interesting because, you know, the broadcasters had De Bruyne in the sort of number nine in the formation. We assume, you know, they meant the false nine. But I mean, he was literally everywhere on the pitch. In the first 20 minutes, he spent a lot of time behind Mahrez, like right on the right wing, which is where we would normally see him playing in that free eight role. And there really was no. But I mean, you know, Sterling is it's almost funny that the goal came from a cross and a header from Sterling, because it felt like there were very few other moves that materialised in that game from City that looked even at all similar to that. Talk to me about De Bruyne's positioning. I appreciate that, you know, that I think Aguero is unavailable, right? But they did have Gabriel Jesus on the bench. What's the benefit of starting with De Bruyne in that nine if you're going to have, you know, essentially an evacuated box for most of the game?
I think the point is to have runners making runs into the box, either like Sterling from left to right, cutting inside, which he did for the goal. And he did do a couple of other times. Or to have Gundogan or Bernardo Silva bursting beyond that line and getting into the box with late runs, which, I mean, City's intention, it seems to me, and I think you're right to assume that Guardiola is doing something deliberate and there's a good reason for it, is to create that space in the box by pulling players forwards or having players pulled out to wide positions to try and shut the wingers down, but then to have players making late runs in there. If you don't have a focal point, then any player can get forwards and get into that box, and that's how Gundogan scored quite a lot of goals recently. And there were players making those runs, possibly not quite as much as they could have done, and it was interesting that Elneny spent quite a lot of time marking whoever that late runner was going to be and sort of blocking them off. And that was quite effective. I think you could see why Arteta had picked that double pivot over perhaps more of a ball-retaining one. But, you know, De Bruyne's roaming around is precisely to sort of be the one who then picks the... I mean, it was interesting. You get moments where City had four forwards in the back line. Sorry, in the forward line, you know, running ahead, and then De Bruyne was dropping off behind them to be the kind of passing option there, and it was working. It was just that for whatever reason, you know, the run didn't quite come off, the pass didn't quite come off, but the gaps were definitely appearing. They just didn't take advantage of them as perhaps they might have done.
Another person I'd like to mention today from the City team is Fernandinho, because he showed, I think, during this game that he's definitely still got it, despite having been second pick to Rodri for most of the season so far. There was this wonderful moment when Bukayo Saka tried to topple him off the ball, and I remember thinking, do you not know who that is? Because that's Fernandinho. You can't just push Fernandinho off the ball. I know he looks, you know, slight and small, because for a defensive midfielder, he sort of is in that slightly odd build, isn't he? He's certainly not big and lumbering. But he had a very, very good game. He nullified the vast majority of Arsenal's attacks. I remember watching him and just feeling the sort of that safe old familiarity of last season, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think the triangle of the sort of central triangle of him, Ruben Dias and John Stones was the reason that Arsenal's attacks amounted to nothing. And I think having Fernandinho back in that central role with the energy, the positional ability, the tactical fouling as well, which is something we did a video on ages and ages ago, but
yeah.
He reads the game so well and cuts off those opportunities at source, sometimes with fouls, but in a sufficiently high position that he's not always going to get booked for them and it doesn't look too cynical. It just allowed the flexibility of the five players in front of him. And also, you know, he was assisted by Zinchenko and Cancelo tucking inside. Cancelo mostly had a very good game in that role. But it kind of felt a little bit like the City of a couple of seasons back when they were racking up the points, because Fernandinho's position just allows everybody else ahead of him to be fluid, to interchange, and to have that security blanket behind. I thought he was outstanding.
That you mentioned Dias as well there, and there was one other moment in the game that felt kind of emblematic of the season, or at least emblematic of the two teams' standings over the last few years, and that was when John Stones kind of eased Aubameyang off the ball. The ball had already basically gone out, but towards the end of the game, and just gave him a quite a big shoulder barge, and he went flying off the pitch. I remember thinking, like, okay, yeah, fair enough. I mean, you can never be sure that Aubameyang has lost control of the ball. He's a very talented player, so maybe he would have brought it back in. It looked like it had already gone out, and perhaps that was unnecessary. Certainly, the power with which it was done was probably a little unnecessary, but it wasn't a foul, and you know, it felt very much like, I don't know, some kind of statement. I'd hesitate to try to put that into words, but do you know what I'm saying?
Well, it was quite late in the game, wasn't it? But it felt like a sort of marker that you put down early on to say, yeah, you're not going to get past me. I'm physically in charge of this area.
Whereas at the end,
even if there's only
like
10
just
minutes
a
to go,
fuck you, just right?
Boom. I mean, basically, and I think, you know, the way that City centre back pairing was protected by the players in front meant they could be quite kind of imperious with the way they did stuff. Obviously, it was Ruben Diaz's crossfield ball to Mahrez that set off the attack that led to the goal. But the two of them they seem to grow in, or not grow in confidence during the game, but they seem to have grown in confidence enormously across the course of the season. Stones, I think, now looks nailed on to start for England at centre-back, which makes a lot of sense.
Diaz, do you think maybe they just understand each other? Because like Laporta is like arguably, technically, a better defender than both of them, right? But at the moment, they are the first choice partnership. They appear to play the best together. Do you think there's maybe a chance that Ruben Diaz arrives and he and John Stones just kind of click and get on from day one?
I think there's a really interesting point there, because I mean, obviously we don't know because we're not there, but that sense of chemistry between certain sort of groups of players, like there's research that's been done in rugby with international teams, and rugby obviously has certain kind of positional groupings like the back row, the second row, the 9-10 pairing. And if the players in those positions in an international team play together at club level, they perform better. The more of those connections there are, the better the team does. And I think it's very difficult to put a value on, but it's also hugely important that the physical chemistry between two players, particularly in, say, the centre-back positions. It would not surprise me if that was part of the reason. I mean, I also think that the greater protection afforded to them has mitigated Stones's occasional weaknesses. You know, he can carry the ball forwards, and he knows very well that someone's going to tuck, usually Cancelo's going to tuck back in. And Cancelo's a big guy for a fullback, so you don't lose much out physically in that regard. He seems less... I guess City's centre-backs are much less exposed this season than they were last season. You know, there's a tighter structure around them. That plays to their strengths, and they've been able to develop and work on their partnership without worrying quite so much about the fact that there's a massive gap in front of them. And I think Fernandinho returning will only improve that.
They like to be swaddled, don't they, centre-backs? Wrapped up all tight like, you know, one baby
yeah,
is
they're
two
just,
large men.
They're just soft now, aren't they, compared to like a Martin yes. Keown or a Tony Adams.
Absolutely.
Those were proper defenders, et cetera,
well, et cetera. Speaking of proper defenders, Arsenal didn't start Gabriel and Luiz. And hey, that sounds like I'm doing a dig at Pablo Mari and Rob Holding. I'm not. I'm just trying to find a nice segue. They didn't start. I asked one of my friends about this. He was saying he thought they were just being rested. I was curious if there was a tactical reason, because it felt like Arteta made quite a few changes ahead of today's game. Was there a tactical reason, Alex, or was it just rotation? Because, I mean, they've got they played on Thursday. They're going to play on Thursday again this week. There's a lot of games coming up for them in a short space of time.
Yeah, I suspect that it is rotation, and the reason for that is that I think from a physical perspective, Gabriel is probably their best defender. I think Holding and Luiz, there's not quite as much to choose between them. Personally, I would have expected Luiz to be there because particularly on the flanks, Arsenal were obviously going for quite a lot of pace with Pepe and Saka. And then even after the change when Aubameyang went left and Lacazette came on. So Luiz's ability to play crossfield passes probably would have been quite helpful in that regard, as Arsenal didn't really get much time on the ball, and I can't have expected that they would have thought they were going to. Having said that, I thought Holding did pretty well, the mistake for the goal aside. Mari, I'm kind of still unconvinced by, and as I said before, you know, the positioning of the two of them, they did drift forwards quite a lot. They did allow gaps in behind. I think if if City had been slightly more clinical, they could have been picked off. But you know, it was an odd one. I think Gabriel's been their best centre-back this season, and Luis's passing is the best range. So rotation has got to be part of it. But then you wonder, does that kind of indicate that either Arteta has real confidence in the reserve players because they're playing Man City, yeah, or Arteta's thinking, we're almost certainly not going to win this, so maybe we should just target the Benfica game instead. It's very difficult to know.
The messaging is slightly strange. Hey, Rob Holding did come off eventually for David Luiz, but in a concussion sub. I'm not sure I've seen one of those in the league before.
Yeah, a little green piece of paper. Was it green or was it pink? Something like that.
It was green, and also I believe the fourth assistant, whatever the name of that referee on the side. You know, the one who just gets shouted at by the managers the whole time.
Yeah, the fourth official.
The fourth official, he had to go and show the green paper to both of the managers. And I remember there was one moment on the broadcast when he was showing it to him. I just assumed this person was a member of City's coaching staff. I'd never seen them before. And he just looked very perplexed. He said, what are you showing me? Why are you showing me this green paper? It was a concussion sub. Hey, we've got a video out today on football's dementia problem as well. So if you haven't seen that, check it out. It's horrible. Sticking with Arsenal, let's talk about Hector Bellerin, because he's not been great for a while now. It's, you know, perhaps surprising that he's still starting. I mean, we were chatting about this over the weekend. Producer Adonis commented that he thinks, you know, it's a bit mad that Maitland-Niles couldn't displace him and instead went out on loan. Seb, given that this isn't game relevant, this question, and that you missed yesterday's game, I'm going to bring this to you now. Talk to me about Hector Bellerin a little bit, because he was always supposed to be the next big thing. For a long time, he was the next big thing. He had a horrible injury, and it doesn't seem like he's the next big thing anymore. In fact, it seems like he was the last next big thing.
Yeah, and really horrible injury. He had a ruptured ligament, which cost him, I think, about 7 or 8 months of a season. And I think it's just sad, Joe, because he looks like a broken player almost. I think one of the early associations with uninjured, unhurt, non-fragile Hector Bellerin was his pace and his dynamism. He was just a very aggressive attacking player. And now all of that kind of urgency seems to have been stripped away. And it's funny, actually, isn't it? Because it's almost that injury occurred at a time when his status was picking up and people were starting to take an interest in him as a not spokesman, but a figurehead for a particular way of thinking about fashion and culture. Because he's an interesting guy, and he's an intelligent guy, and he's got a lot of things to say which are worth listening to. And it's almost as if, because of that rising profile, the decline in his playing career has gone a little bit unnoticed. And so now when we talk about it, it feels as if it's snuck up on us. Is that fair? I don't know.
I think so. Alex, what do you think?
Well, when we did Arsenal's Sensible Transfers video in January, that position was one that I identified as being a weak area. You know, Bellerin simply doesn't contribute enough in an attacking perspective to be worth his defensive frailties. You know, the number of duels he wins is really pretty low, and he's kind of comparable to what you'd expect from a very attacking wing back, but without the attacking output. And I guess,
and lots of yellow cards,
an inability to take throw-ins, which continues to be baffling. But I think there's two issues. Firstly, Arsenal don't have somebody else in that position. That's a kind of a natural. I mean, yes, Maitland-Niles is a good player, and I thought actually did well for West Brom in the game against Burnley. Really nice kind of snappy midfield performance. But he, you know, he's a versatile player, isn't he? He's not definitively a right back.
He didn't want to play at right back either, right?
I don't know. I will take your word for that.
No, I just mean, like, let's say you're a young player, you're at your parent club, you've got two options. If you stay there, you can maybe play a bit more at right back, or if you go somewhere else, you can play in midfield. I mean,
I think if the opportunity to start in midfield is there, yes, I guess that makes sense. But, you know, without a natural person who's kind of pressing and looking to displace somebody there in that position. And also with what Seb says, you know, Bellerin amongst the fan base is incredibly popular. He's an articulate, thoughtful, progressive individual.
He's a cool guy.
he's a cool guy. You know, he does a lot of cool stuff. And I think that there is an affection and an esteem around Arsenal for him in terms of the fan base. I assume that extends to the playing staff as well. And so maybe he gets a bit more latitude there. But it's impossible to know. I mean, you know, he does still have good performances. I just don't think he's a consistently top-level right-back. And given how important full-backs are to the way a lot of modern teams attack, and given the impact that Tierney has on the left when he's playing well. I mean, Tierney, basically everything that Arsenal did well against Man City came through Tierney. You know, if they had that ability on the right-hand side as well, it would make a difference.
He's also a stalwart, I suppose, but he's been there for a long time. Anyway, I like his face and the way he handles his business. I like it.
I like his accent. His accent's fascinating to me. It's kind of, he sounds a lot like, I heard Emi Martinez, the Aston Villa goalkeeper, talk for the first time the other day. And they sound very similar. And it's not like, their accent isn't like a blend of different cultures and different languages. It's like one part of a sentence is from North London, and another is from some, yeah, somewhere else.
I went out with a girl once whose family were Uruguayan, but she had spent most of her time growing up in Sweden, and then she moved to London when she was 15, and she had this sort of strange international Cockney accent, and it was very fun. Anyway, Seb, City, 10-point lead. Is it over now?
Game over.
It is game over, isn't it? Which is funny because it felt like only 4 weeks ago that we were saying, what, who's going to, who, what, hello? And now, oh, fuck, yeah, forgot about that. When the two closest followers are Leicester and Man United, you feel like both those teams have losses left in them in a way that City just don't, right? And Liverpool are currently in sixth place, so there goes that bang.
I also feel like, and it's something we've already covered, but when that Stones-Diaz partnership revealed itself and started to grow, the kind of the last straw to clutch at disappeared, because City's attacking strength is what it is, and you know there's a little bit of an issue in midfield, which was exacerbated by Fernandinho periodically having to be dropped back in. Seeing as they fixed that area, there's something quite inevitable about what followed, I think.
Yeah, I really like how you said exacerbated.
Hey, I'm a cosmopolitan man. I live in Europe now. It's okay.
Stones and Diaz have got 11 clean sheets in the 13 games they've started together, which is just formidable, isn't it?
Hot diggity dog. Well, let's cross the country now to discuss a derby that happened on the Merseyside.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay. Here we are in Merseyside. It's Liverpool 0-2 Everton. So, I mean, obviously, let's start with Liverpool. All the records related to this game, yada yada, there were plenty of them. Liverpool now outside the European places, yet to win a game, a league game, I should say, yet to win a league game in February. Jordan Henderson also added to the injury list. Seb, it's all gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Horribly, horribly, horribly wrong, Joe, but also not entirely unpredictable, because I feel like this is now a trend with Liverpool. And actually, I've heard from a few Everton fans in the aftermath of this game, where I've been sort of watching their interactions on social media, and there's been a little bit of umbrage in the way that the media is focused on Liverpool and focused on Jurgen Klopp's body language and press conference demeanour. But it felt unsurprising, which is a really strange thing to say about a result which nobody has seen since 1999. All the elements that made up that game, so Liverpool's domination of certain areas of the pitch, but inability to create chances when it really mattered. This is something we've seen before. Their fragility at the back was something we're pretty familiar with too. Also, their inability to deal with a particular type of direct attacking player, i.e. Richarlison, not a new thing, of course. It's really strange to see a team who have knocked down every obstacle in their path for the last 3 or 4 years fail repeatedly to clamber over the same one week after week. It's a very, very strange place to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's start then by talking about Richarlison for Everton and his performance, because ironically, it was the kind of knifing inside forward that Liverpool seemed to lack, Seb.
That's a nice little bit of writing there.
Good. Yeah, thanks. I was very proud of when I wrote that down in my notes, not you.
The best description I've heard of Liverpool's defence at the moment is that it's basically, there's no chemistry there at all. It's just four individual players, or sometimes three. And I think when you have someone like Richarlison, who is very direct, who's skillful, who does things quickly, I think that's the ultimate nightmare for a group which aren't cohesive. And I know it's a little bit after the fact to be saying this, but when Richarlison scored that first goal, if you were, before that game kicked off, if you were to imagine a goal that Liverpool might concede and the player who might score it, everything would have looked like that, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree. That makes sense. Sorry, I wasn't expecting you to finish so soon. I wasn't actually prepared for my next question. But now I am. And it goes like this. Alex, moving on swiftly from Seb's abrupt ending there, let's talk about Michael Keane, because, you know, Michael Keane was a bit of a standing joke a year or so ago. But now he's the centrepiece of Ancelotti's defence. Alongside, it's worth mentioning, Mason Holgate, who in particular was fantastic against Liverpool, and also Godfrey. You know, they both had brilliant games. They look super assured as a unit, with Keane as the marshal. Talk to me about that, because that is a prized asset.
Yeah, when Everton had this good start to the season, I remember Paddy Boyland at The Athletic highlighting just how important Keane was to that. And I think he's always been a slightly divisive player. I personally think in large part because of his performances for England, where, you know, England, I think in 2019, conceded most of their goals through individual errors, about half of which were by Michael Keane. and that, you know, that sort of, you know, giving the ball, this is when Southgate was trying to develop the playing out from the back style, and Michael Keane in particular seemed to take that as meaning give the opposition the ball within about 20 yards of goal and then backpedal frantically. But as time has gone on, he has become a lot more assured. I mean, Ancelotti set up in this game with having, you know, Seamus Coleman and Dean effectively as wing backs, but able to tilt into more of a back four when out of possession sometimes. It afforded Everton's unit a lot more cover. I also think it's worth pointing out, and I'm pretty sure someone said this in the WhatsApp as well, it's the best game from Pickford I've seen in ages, which again helped. But Keane, I think...
That.
Oh, massively, yeah.
Particularly because the narrative around this game is this. Just... Yeah, which is like... I know, and listen, I don't want to take this away from Liverpool fans at all. Obviously, injury luck this season has been woeful. And nobody who remembers this season is going to forget that, you know. However, the sort of constant reference of that challenge is kind of grating after a while. And I think it was very important, you know, psychologically for Jordan Pickford to have a good game so as to sort of shoo away some of those ghosts, you know.
Oh, for sure. But I think to return to Keane, he seems to have taken on more of a sort of leadership mantle. I think, you know, the players that he's playing with, whether it's Holgate or Godfrey or even Yerry Mina, they are younger, they're less experienced. And I think having that sense of, I'm the person who has to sort out this line, I'm the person who has to organise things, has been really beneficial for Keane. I think, again, the back line got a lot more protection. I thought Tom Davis was absolutely superb in this game. running around, making tackles, breaking up play, kind of being a bit of a dick sometimes, but in that way that is very, very useful in a defensive midfielder. And it just gave them all a lot more confidence. And I think as, you know, as the season has progressed, Keane has got better and better, and looks very much more assured. He doesn't look like he's got the same kind of mistake in him now.
I can't believe Michael Keane's 28 years old. That's
he's now going to go and make a massive mistake in his next game, because that's what happens yeah. whenever we talk somebody up. But yeah,
I remember him as like a youth player. I remember thinking Will Keane was going to be better. You know, fucking idiot. Anyway, Seb, I'm going to ask you now about Mason Holgate, because, you know, Mason Holgate, more like Mason hold the phone. This guy's great gate. Yeah.
Sorry, I was temporarily stunned by finding out that Tom Davis is still only 22. It feels like he must have made his Premier League debut at 13. It's been around forever now.
He stole some of Michael Keane's youth, because that would explain why they're in the opposite directions than what I expect them to be. You know, he did a bit of life sucking. You should know about it very well, Seb. You do it to me on a daily basis.
Mason Holgate. Let's do Mason Holgate.
Mason Holgate.
Mason Holgate, I like, because it feels like for a long time he was caught between managers who either wanted him to, well, let's face it, not be on the pitch, or to play between fullback and centre half. And as a result, he didn't really evolve definitively in either direction. Had a mistake in his game. But it feels like this version of him has kind of captured all the good parts of his skill set. So what is Mason Holgate? Like, good footballer, first and foremost, a really nice fit on the right side of a defence.
He's feisty.
He is feisty. And we talked about Tom Davis, and Holgate fits into that category too, because sometimes when Everton have gone to Anfield, or even just played in any kind of Merseyside derby, like after the kind of the Tim Cahill, Duncan Ferguson era, they've lacked a few players who have been willing to be a pain, who have been willing to challenge Liverpool. Because I think this generation, particularly, if you think of, for instance, Andy Robertson's most petulant moments, where he gets away with a few naughty things during games, Everton don't really have those players, or haven't. And I always think back to that FA Cup game where they lost to the Curtis Jones goal, when Liverpool fielded a side with an average age of about 14 and a half. And they just got brushed aside. Like, that, like, Everton have been working at a talent deficit for a while, yes. But they've also been had a natural inferiority and a sort of a fear to them in this fixture. And Holgate and Davis, they're important parts of the response to that, I think. And it's almost as important as anything they bring with the ball at their feet.
No, I like it. I like that guy's attitude. I think he just looks well up for it all the time. And that's the kind of... That's why I like.
Can we?
Footballer.
I think. Can we give a little mention to Ben Godfrey as well? Because I thought he was very good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really like him.
Ex Norwich legend, of course.
Yes, well, indeed.
I was going to say that this kind of back three-ish setup, when you've got Godfrey and Holgate on the sides of that back three, they both have played as fullbacks as well, and so you have two players who are perfectly capable of centre backs, and Godfrey also. Played as a defensive midfielder when he was on loan. So you've got players that are versatile, who understand both elements of defending wide areas, either as a centre-back or as a full-back. And I think that gives a back three an additional versatility, an additional ability to cover those wide areas if the full-backs or wing-backs are caught out of position. It makes a lot of sense to use players like that in those positions.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, the last Everton player I would like to mention is the one mentioned least, I imagine. Dominic Calvert-Lewin came back super quickly from injury. He replaced Rodriguez in this game, which I think is one of those. Again, I know I'm referencing moments a lot in today's podcast, but it felt like an important moment because, of course, James Rodriguez is James Rodriguez, an international global star, all of the skills in the world, played at Real Madrid, played at Bayern Munich. Here he is in a game, you know, 1-0 up. It's pretty much on a knife edge at this point too. And he's being taken off the pitch and replaced by Dominic Calvert-Lewin. And you think, actually, that's a good thing. You know, Dominic Calvert-Lewin, he's going to make an impact on this game. And so he did. He made life very difficult for Liverpool when he came on. And he played his part in the goal too. It feels like, given his form this season, it's going to be weird to just see him riding the bench for England at the Euros, Seb.
It really does. And, you know, you'd like to think that a creative mind somewhere at the FA would be able to come up with a way of using him in an efficient way. Because
I mean, Harry Kane started the season very well, undoubtedly, undeniably, and he's probably going to end as, you know, golden boot or whatever. But it's hard to say that his form in the last 2 or 3 months has been exceptional.
Also, if you're forward thinking and you accept that without Harry Kane, Tottenham don't really exist, and there is no such thing as Jose Mourinho Spurs without Kane and Son and that partnership, I think, can you really imagine Kane actually turning up at the Euros fresh? He's going to have to play at every point now, because Spurs' season is, it's almost at the point of being irretrievable. And
what you're saying is, don't take him to the Euro, I think.
Leave him alone. Let him have a summer's golfing on the Algarve or something.
Let him rest. And just, the World Cup's coming up, you know.
Hey Joe, you know what's really, really interesting about Calvert-Lewin is when you take him out of the Everton side, you're left with something very similar to the situation at Spurs with Kane. So I if you compare this game with Everton's defeat at Goodison to Fulham, where there was no Calvert-Lewin and where all the forward moves, all the attacking moves kind of died very easily. And, you know, they played in a kind of, they played in flares rather than in moves, if that makes sense. And it did just go to show how complete a player he is. And then when he came on at Anfield, and when he came on against a team, against a defence who had already lost Jordan Henderson, who were patched up and lacking confidence and, you know, had all kinds of imbalances, you saw the difference. He is a nightmare to play against.
What is his value, do you think? Because,
what,
I mean,
financially?
You know, look, because something, and I know I've mentioned this on the podcast before, Everton fans are going to hate me for saying this, but I mentioned a couple of weeks ago he seems like the perfect player for Manchester United, as an example, right? The reason I think that is because I think, if anything, from this season, what's been shown by Manchester United's performances and players is that they don't need Jadon Sancho, they need a replacement for Edinson Cavani at the end of this season, or certainly at the end of the next season if he stays for another year. They need that focal point, that striker. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin seems like the absolute perfect person for that position. Now, again, apologies to Everton fans, but it's something that strikes me as a bit of an obvious one in some ways. But what is his value, do you think?
Enormous, because if you think of him less as a part of this team and more as a component within a project which might have 5 years to run, and you think about what the likely effect is of surrounding him with better players. So this season,
what Ancelotti might do if they sell him, you know, as in he might.
Well,
leave,
yeah, but right? I take the Man United aspect out of it, because that's a little bit antagonistic. But just say he stayed at Everton and they were able to put a couple of additional James Rodriguez's. Is that the right way of pluralizing James Rodriguez?
Sure. Yeah.
James's.
Yeah.
Many Hammers.
I think Rodriguez's.
Rodriguez's, okay.
Many JRs.
I like that. Many JRs. Okay, so if you're able to put many JRs around him, you probably bet on his game becoming even more rounded. And as has been the case throughout his career to this point, you know, he would reveal different parts of himself as a centre forward. And I think that's what's really interesting. And so if that's the likely scenario, his value to Everton at the moment is absolutely enormous, because he's the centrepiece of everything that they'd be wanting to be doing over the short term.
Also, Man United would destroy him, like they destroy
somehow
every
they would
player.
Find a way. I know this is going to be.
You can see my. I don't mean to be antagonistic though, but you can see why
knee jerk
I say that, right? Because it just feels like something that 15 years ago would have happened. It doesn't feel like something that's going to happen now. But it feels like 15 years ago, that's the sort of thing that would have happened. And tactically speaking, there's an option there. I don't think he should leave. I think this Everton team are exciting and fantastic, and presumably they have some way to grow as well, as you're saying, Seb.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it'd be antagonistic. I think this is just the age-old reflex in English football: is young English player plays well, therefore he must move to Manchester United as quickly as possible. I think we're all guilty of it. And that's been the case for so long that it is a reflex. I wonder whether the biggest argument, actually, from a neutral perspective, from staying there, is that you want interesting players who change and develop over time at different clubs. Because I want a reason to watch Everton beyond just Everton are playing another team in what should be a good fixture or a, you know, competitive match. I want to watch a game in which I'm going to learn something about a player. Like I'm going to see something that I didn't think he could do, or I'm going to see him score a type of goal, or, you know, with a type of finish that he's acquired over the last couple of months or weeks or something. That's really what's interesting. And so if you,
or I'm only interested in transfers, that's my main,
you just, you're,
main
you are, you have that insatiable appetite for transfers and, you know, just spending money, and you just love capitalism that much. I mean,
I really do.
Down to a T, you really do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the end of that conversation, isn't it? Other than to say, Alex Stewart, England manager, who do you pick? You pick Harry Kane or DCL to start?
Well, there's two answers to this. The first is it depends on who you're playing.
One is DCL and one is Harry Kane.
Yeah, very good. I wonder if there's a way of accommodating. I mean, Seb's absolutely right about the physical state Kane is likely to go to the Euros in. I do wonder if there's a way of playing the two of them together with either almost in a 4-4-2. Or playing Kane as effectively a number 10 behind Calvert-Lewin. I think the thing that Calvert-Lewin brings is the ability to play against the two main types of defences you're going to come across, which are, you know, if you're playing against ball-playing defenders who want to play out from the back, his pressing and his energy is incredibly useful. If you're playing against a packed deep defence, his ability in the air and his physicality pressing against the defender and pushing back is also really helpful.
They'd be so physical, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah, and I think the thing with the Calvert-Lewin over Kane argument is that you can envisage a situation in which England, say England go into a 4-2-3-1, they could field a front four with so much pace and energy that it would be kind of terrifying for most teams to play against. You know, think of the wide options, people like Rashford, Sancho, Sterling, Foden, even people like James Maddison playing in the 10 role. You know, would Kane slightly slow that down, possibly? But I do feel like, you know, the other sensible argument to make about this England team is that they are young, and, you know, if Henderson is ruled out, for example, which is being talked about today, where is the leadership coming from in a young team like that? And Kane does bring enormous international experience and leadership as the captain. And there is,
I like
there
it. Is play him argument. As the 10.
Well, I possibly play him as a 10, or I think this England team in a sort of very attacking 4-4-2 could do something quite exciting. I would actually consider dropping Trent Alexander-Arnold if we did that, though, and have a slightly more defensively minded.
Dog. What, Aaron Wan-Bissaka?
I don't know,
she
maybe.
She's really getting shaken up now. You're dropping a Liverpool player to include an Everton player.
Well, I'd have Luke Shaw at left back as well. I don't know. I think England are in a position where they've got lots and lots of issues, but they're all good ones.
Sure. Well, we're going to come on to talk about Ben Chilwell, coincidentally, after this little break. A quick chat about some Chelsea stuff.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, it's Chelsea. Of course, Chelsea had a game, didn't they? And the game was Southampton 1-1 Chelsea. But we're not going to talk about Southampton today. We've done that a little bit recently. However, here's what we are going to discuss. Callum Hudson-Odoi was subbed as a sub. He was subbed as a sub. Subbed as a sub. I haven't written a jingle for that yet, but you can hear. Subbed as a sub. Yeah. Thomas Tuchel said the following. I was not happy with his attitude, energy, and counter-pressing. A new quote. He needs to be trustworthy and reliable, and that is the next step for him. Seb, how did that show? Because you've written here in my notes. I find that quite troubling. Chelsea have played 5 games in 16 days, and Hudson-Odoi has been a sub in 2 of them. It's quite bold to single out a player under those conditions, more so to be that damning after the fact.
Yeah, I just found some of the language a bit troubling. It was just really harsh. Attitude, trustworthiness. I also think maybe, I think this is a really easy trap to fall into. I think we're all a little bit guilty of forgetting just how weird the world is, the football world is at the moment, and just what a strange situation this is for a lot of players. And I felt like, we talked about this before when we did our big thing on subs being subbed, and I think it's kind of more what happens afterwards than the act itself. And in this case, it's not just being subbed. It's not just that happening on a, you know, marquee television game at a, you know, peak time slot. It's also, I don't know, it just felt very accusatory. I found it strange. I think presumably it was instructed by the lack of pressing in Callum Hudson-Odoi's game. Didn't exert much pressure on Southampton's backline when he came on. Fine, okay. But I felt a lot of Chelsea players were guilty of that. I don't think this was a very good Chelsea performance all over the pitch. I thought there were huge issues at the back. I thought the fullbacks were relatively poor. Alonso was good with the ball, but as is seemingly typical with him, pretty crap without it. And so if you were going to point a finger as a manager, I felt that there were other places to do that. And this felt like an instance maybe where the subbing a sub dynamic, it's a little bit of a way of localizing and isolating your team's issues. Maybe not making a point, but creating a talking point, which is apart from your team being a bit shit. It's the Mourinho sub.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay. I mean, I suppose I'm trying to think about it from the perspective of Thomas Tuchel and what options he has. I mean, if you think that's genuinely going to impact the game positively, then I suppose it's an understandable substitution to make. However, it does mean you're going to be asked directly about it after the game, right? And that's obviously what happened here. And there's no option for him to say, well, he was a bit tired and obviously it's not an injury, and he's making that point clear too. So you either, I guess, are you advocating that you kind of say nothing, I suppose, or just sort of be a little more vague? Because it's quite direct, isn't it?
Yeah, but it would hardly be unprecedented for a manager to play a straight bat to that kind of question. You could give a terse answer. You could just say it was tactical, or we needed to make another change, or you can be intentionally vague and let the kind of let the media fill in the gaps by themselves, which I accept is a prompt to write things which might even be more damaging. I just felt it to be quite bold. I might be being completely unfair. I was just quite taken aback by.
No, you're using empathy, Seb. Don't be confused.
Well, he was just
what's happening
abusive,
is like you're feeling something for a player and you're acting upon that feeling, and that's absolutely fine. We mustn't forget here, and I know we have a lot of close proximity to Alex, so sometimes this gets confusing for us, Seb, but I need you to stay with me as a human being, okay? Because it's important that at least 2 of us can do that.
I mean, feelings, like in the Tifo WhatsApp chat, anytime I express a feeling or a sentiment, I feel like I'm heading into kind of a taboo area. Like it's making somebody else in the group feel uncomfortable.
The response is always...
Over time it becomes like an aversion. You know, you stop doing something, you repress your ability to respond in a compassionate way.
I've got to read this tweet because it's a very funny... It was a comment, I think, a comment. I posted this in the Tifo podcast WhatsApp chat yesterday because it was somebody left a comment under one of our videos, and I'm just scrolling to find it. I'm ever so sorry. So this was a comment left underneath one of our videos from last week by Ranting Swede, And I feel that it just summarized both Alex and Sepp very well. Alex in a way that I have heard summarized several times. Sepp in a way that is slightly more unique. The comment reads as such. Alex, as the director of sport, has been told he can sign either Haaland or Mbappe to strengthen Spurs after Kane and Son have departed. Alex says, "That sounds nice, but I want to look at this tidy midfielder from the Bulgarian Sunday League." At this point in the comment, I'm thinking, yeah, sure, listen. We've heard this before. This is it's an exaggeration. It's deliberately over-exaggerated. That's where the humour comes in. There's a conflict with reality. I understand what's happening. It's not, you know, it doesn't do anything for me. I get it. I see. But the comment goes on. The comment says, Seb says he has some long legs as well, so that would be a great signing. And I know we've talked about legs before, but it's really, truly struck me when I read that comment how often it is actually that Seb actually talks about how long a player's legs are. I don't know why I just remembered that, but it's something to do with it. Anyway, Marcus Alonso has seemingly sidelined Ben Chilwell.
Relatively long legs on Marcus Alonso.
Here we go. Okay, I'm looking for Sherlock Holmes here. Chelsea spent £50 million or so, or more, I can't remember, on Ben Chilwell. The board would presumably be keen to see him play, obviously. It's been quite a lot of money there. And yet, .. What is the suitability here? I'm going to come to you, Alex. Suitability here to Tuchel's style of football? Why is Marcus Alonso, you know, the man who always comes back? Why is he coming back again?
I think probably because he's slightly better at holding the ball. He's less dynamic, but that exposes Chelsea lefts on that left-hand side. It's a bit more patient. It's a bit more possession-focused. Chilwell's more about energy and getting forwards. I also have a vague sense that Chilwell was probably the one signing of those big signings that were made that was a Lampard signing. Lampard really was keen on Chilwell. Not necessarily that he wasn't keen on the other ones, but I just wonder whether there's a slight kind of sense of him having fitted more into that style than what Tuchel wants to do. And Tuchel wants a slightly more, I don't want to say thoughtful player, but, you know, Chilwell's about energy and getting forwards, and Alonso's a bit more patient and circumspect with the ball.
Seb, go.
Is Marcus Alonso the most overachieving footballer ever? If you look at what he is and the way he moves around a pitch and his flaws, and yet somehow he survives at Chelsea. And he does quite well. Like, his statistics are fairly positive. He's always had a pretty decent tangible output. And like, you can never fully escape the idea that, oh mate, you should probably still be playing for, I don't know. He's a kind of player that would show up in late January to a club threatened by relegation. And yet somehow, every time Chelsea make a managerial change, back he comes. He would survive the apocalypse, Marcus Alonso. He just
you say
he
he's
so
like a
resistant.
Footballing cockroach.
He'd be like bacteria, some types of fish, possibly a bit of plant life, and Marcus Alonso juggling a football whilst, you know, nuclear winter is setting in. It's extraordinary.
He is a player about whom I can say almost nothing because he never really stands out to me in any conceivable way. Like, there's not, it's very difficult to look at Marcus Alonso and go, oh, that's what you're bringing. I don't know. It is an odd one.
And also, managers seem to either really, really like him and remain completely loyal to him, or absolutely hate him and bin him off at the first opportunity. Lampard, obviously, you know, a charter member of the latter category. But it's just strange that it's, because I don't think Ben Chilwell is the world's best fullback, and I don't think he's even necessarily in the top three for English fullbacks at the moment. But at the same time, it's almost like a reflex, isn't it? Like, oh, I'm a new manager at Stamford Bridge, and things got to get better. Right, get Marcus Alonso on the side right away. And you just think that's a natural response with a kind of, I don't know, a Diego Costa or
when Tim Sherwood did it with Emmanuel Adebayor, because it's like, okay, you know, use the guy that's sort of been jilted and has a point to prove, fine. But then Marcus Alonso comes back in and just does all the same things that he was doing 2 years ago. And he sort of trundles down the wing and, you know, scores nice goals, good technique, good finisher, you know, throws in the odd defensive calamity. Honestly, it's baffling. And yet, on he goes. On he goes.
It seems like it's, you know, almost a bad idea to just repeatedly hire new managers and spend lots of money for each of them with different thoughts about what they want to do.
I remember being in one of Maurizio Sarri's first press conferences at Stamford Bridge. Must have been like the autumn of whenever he first arrived. And he said something like, Marcus Alonso is the best fullback in Europe. And
I
somebody
remember
actually
that.
Laughed. Yeah, but somebody in the press conference laughed. And you remember when you were at school and something would happen and one person in the room would laugh uncontrollably, and because they were embarrassed about it, just kept laughing and they were unable to kind of suppress
that person
it.
Was me.
It just became funnier and funnier and funnier. Yeah, exactly. You know, it'd be the person laughing at the innuendo or the inadvertent sex joke. And it was like that. I can't remember who it was. It was somebody I didn't recognise, but someone just started giggling and just, it was really awkward, just wouldn't stop giggling.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we've come sort of to the end of the podcast now, but one more thing to cover is Joe's lists and player quotes facts. It's Joe's quotes and facts database. There we go. We've only got time for one today because, again, I forgot that I do this because I don't keep it in my head as a thing that's important because, you know, just leaving
you
a little blank spot.
Such
there,
a fuss about including this, though, didn't you?
You know it's on the plan every time.
You actually reminded me to put it on there when it wasn't.
I wrote this plan. I didn't put it on because I forgot that this was a thing. But no, the players, Joes, and facts quotes. And today we've got time for one that I just researched. If you're listening to this and thinking, huh, Joe didn't moderate that conversation about Alonso quite as well as he normally would do. He didn't stop Alex and Seb when they grew boring and he let them continue for 2 or 3 minutes longer than he would normally have done. And I don't know why I'm disappointed about that. And I think I wish he had moderated it in his normal fashion. Well, listener, I'll let you in on a little inside secret. I didn't moderate it because I needed them to fill because I was looking for one. Ben Chilwell, player quotes and facts list. Ben Chilwell, position left back, of course. Fact. He went to Redbourne Upper School. Now, the reason that that is an interesting fact, only for me and not for anyone else, is because I lived in a place called Flitwick for a while as a child, which is in Bedfordshire, right? And the secondary school that I would have gone to, that my sister Alice, who works for TIFO, went to for 1 year before we moved again, was Redbourne Upper School. So there you go. It's a small world, isn't it? Isn't it a very, very small, small world? Redbourne. And also, Ben Chilwell's quote accompanying two pictures of him in the snow at an assumed Stamford Bridge. Ben Chilwell's quote on Twitter says, "Chilly outside today." You know? And I just thought, nice. Very proud of yourself, aren't you, Ben Chilwell? It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. Well, we're going to end the podcast now because we wandered into places unknown and had to cut out stuff that we said. So that's why it was jarring. But anyway, thanks to you, Seb Stafford-Blore.
Thank you very much, Joe Devine.
And to you, Alex Stewart.
Thank you, Joe.
We'll be back on Friday with more game-relevant podcasting about whatever happens in this midweek. Au revoir.
Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.